This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Scotland Outdoors Podcast from BBC Radio Scotland.
Hello, and thanks very much for choosing to listen to this podcast. I'm Helen Needham. Over the years of doing this podcast, we've talked a lot about nature writing, a genre which has grown in prominence over the past decade. What we haven't highlighted before is nature writing from the perspective of people living with chronic illness or disability. Louise Kenward is a psychologist, artist and writer based in the south of England. For the past few years, she's been living with chronic illness, which has, at times, meant she's been completely isolated and unable to leave her house. Louise isn't the only one. Over a quarter of the UK population are chronically ill or disabled. And since the COVID-19 pandemic, this statistic is rising. In a new anthology curated by Louise called Moving Mountains, Writing Nature Through Illness and Disability, the standard narratives of the genre are challenged, from the idea of nature cure to the dominant concept of ableism and the idea that there's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing. I found this collection mind-expanding, especially how the storytelling involving the natural world and the more than human world is used to express things like pain, fatigue, discomfort, and isolation, all common features of living with illness or disability. I spoke with Louise recently, and we began by discussing the notion of nature cure and the common assumption that we can all be healed if we just spend more time outside.
There are lots of people who get great enjoyment and fulfillment and benefit from spending time in nature, which is fantastic. As I do, I value my time in nature enormously. I think the danger comes when it becomes reductive. As with any of those things, there's a surge in popularity and an assumption that that's the best kind of treatment for everybody and that it will suit everybody. And of course, nothing ever does. And I think in terms of ideas of the nature cure, it can be harmful for people, who just don't like spending time outdoors, don't want to. That's not a soothing place for some people. And for people like me who live with quite complex chronic illness, for which there's no real helpful medical understanding, in a way that there's no real helpful medical treatment available. And so being outdoors has its own challenges. There's barriers for me in spending time outdoors because I live with quite profound energy limitations at different times. And so it can be quite harmful to my health if I was to push myself beyond my capabilities to spend time and to try to walk, for example, when I'm not able to. So it has that counter effect. And additionally, I think the expectation that nature will cure us, I think, is another example of the kind of themes of extractivism, that we can take something from nature. The idea of nature on prescription, while is great for some people, I think the attitude we come to nature can be harmful, in that there's not that reciprocity of nurturing nature as much as nurturing ourselves.
Well, it just raises all sorts of questions about how we perceive ourselves in the world, doesn't it? Which have come up within some of the writing that we're going to be talking about in a minute. And that whole thing of nature as a resource for us as human beings. One of the interesting things you point out as well is the fact that there are increasing levels of chronic illness and disability in the world, and you link this with the climate crisis. Can you explain that a bit more?
We are still midst a pandemic, and it's shown that there will be more pandemics in relation to an escalating climate crisis. It's part and parcel of the same process. There's also a real lack of engagement of disabled people in the kind of disaster planning for the climate crisis. And yet disabled people are most at risk very often of, for example, extreme temperatures. And yet disabled people aren't considered in the kind of disaster planning for escaping or managing in difficult situations.
But also, could there be a connection with the fact that the environment is under attack and it's actually having a health issues, it's causing more health issues as well?
Certainly. And the statistics show since the Industrial Revolution, things like pollution in the atmosphere has led to an increase in allergies, for example, asthma and so on have increased. And I think the idea that the human and the non-human world, or the more than human world, are somehow separate is a real misnomer. We are part and parcel of the same atmosphere, the same water table, the same climate. What effect one will affect the other. And I think the false separation of the two is really harmful, because it gives us a kind of false sense of security that of this separation, and that we're protected somehow. And yet that's not the case. There is certain privilege that will protect us and protect those with more privilege at a greater degree for longer. But ultimately, we are all breathing the same air, drinking from the same water sources. What contaminates one will contaminate the other. And the kind of pollution in the rivers and seas at the moment is actively demonstrating that, I think, around the UK now.
The storytelling aspect of this is central, really, because it provides an opportunity for people who have chronic illness and disability to actually share and express what they go through and things that people may not think about: pain, fatigue, shame, but also a real, in some cases, deep connection with that more than human world, seeing the world, connecting with the natural world in different ways.
It's amazing, isn't it? And it's such a diverse collection of writing and experiences. I couldn't have imagined it would be so rich with all these kind of different textures. And I think those themes you pick up on of fatigue and pain and shame are the kind of themes that are experienced universally. So illness and disability might be seen as a kind of monolith as the same thing, and it really isn't, as the book shows. It's very individual, everybody's experience. And yet the kind of themes that come up again and again are shared. And certainly in terms of disability, pain and fatigue are two of the most common symptoms experienced generally. So for those to come through really strongly is really powerful. And the kind of ways that different writers have connected with those have really helped me think again about how I explain and how I describe pain. And I think Sally Hubin's piece at the start of the anthology particularly is really, really powerful in looking at the kind of beachcombing process that she has as part of her writing and day-to-day living in Shetland Islands, and how having that image of what it feels like in her body to live with pain.
The imagery that she used is so effective. She uses the example of a metal fish hook snagged on a dead gannet's wing that she came across when she was out beachcombing. And she uses that to describe different types of pain that she experiences herself. And, you know, when the line is slack, someday the hook's slightly felt, other days it's taut and sharp pull, and then it's reeled in. And it's I just felt so moved by that, actually. And it was the kind of thing that I'd never come across before.
Absolutely. It's beautiful writing, but also the use of that imagery. And I think all the more powerful because earlier in the piece, she talks about having lost her words, having been undermined in medical appointments, so much so she'd been dismissed that the language she had been lost. And so it was by these experiences that she was able to rebuild a vocabulary for her experiences.
And she goes on to talk about fatigue as well and describes it as salt spray on windows, and it's always the hard, the kind that weighs heavy. She also uses a term which I've noticed comes throughout some of the pieces, body mind.
So the notion that we are a body mind, so there is this false dichotomy between brain and body or mind and body, something that I think Eli Clare was, if not the one of the first people to use that term to capture that experience of that whole embodied sense of being body and mind all in one, and that both impact each other and can't be separated from one another. That there's often a false dichotomy in Western medicine between mental health and physical health. And I think the pieces show there's much more blurring between the two.
Yeah, and thrown into particular light because so many of the people writing, it's their body, you know, they're, well, how to put this, potentially restricted by body. So it's so much of your being, isn't it? That you can't necessarily always do the things that you might want to do. Because of the pain or fatigue or some kind of physical thing going on.
And I think the joy of the writing is also about how much our imagination and the creativity that can come out of those experiences as well.
Totally. And a wonderful example of that is Abby Palmer, who is very much living within the space of her flat, I think somewhere in London, with her cats. Can you just give a short synopsis of what she actually does?
So Abby has two cats she adopts, I think just before or during the lockdowns at the beginning of the COVID pandemic, and they're house cats. So she fears that they are unable to fully experience the world because they can't go outside. She lives in a flat with limited access to the outside world. So brilliantly and ingeniously creates boxes of outside experience for her cats, which she entitles Abby Palmer Invents the Weather. And they're regular cardboard boxes. The rain is the first one, and the sun and heat is the second, fog and autumn. It tracks the seasonal changes of the year.
But it's such a beautiful idea, isn't it? Actually taking the outdoors in and how powerful that can be.
Very much so. And it's a real dialogue with her cats as well. And she's included photographs of the cats, and they've become real characters in themselves, in that sense of their curiosity and what they do and don't like or do and don't respond to. And it's a really beautiful domestic way for Abby to relate to the uncertainty and the fears that she has of the world, of the climate crisis, of the pandemic, of living in a disabled body. It brings it to the very small, manageable, domestic, relatable spaces that we all have. Bringing the outside in these cardboard boxes is a real microcosm of the world in this London flat.
The next writer that I'd like to talk about is originally from Indonesia, Karani Baroka. she finds herself in hospital in London, staring at Big Ben from St. Thomas's Hospital. And this unleashes a huge series of thoughts about the connection of her own homeland and what's going on, colonialism, deforestation, with her particular illness. It's kaleidoscopic and mind-blowing.
Karani Baroka's piece, The Clock Tower and the Canopy, reflects on her own experiences and is an Indonesian woman, and the loss of connection she's had through colonialism, whereby disabled people were, there are disabled gods in Indonesia. There's the celebration of disability, there's knowledge of disability and of pain management and pain medication from the Indonesian rainforest, and how much loss of knowledge has happened and loss of care has happened as a process of the colonial violence in Indonesia. And so she's reflecting from a pain clinic in London, which is overlooking Big Ben, and it brings up all of these beautiful, powerful connections for her.
It also is very illuminating because it brings to the fore the fact that the way that in Western cultures we might perceive the natural world as other, but within her culture, there's no distinction between humans and nature.
That's right. That whole notion of language and words we use that we don't question. And I think that's one of the brilliant things in including such a diverse range of voices in the anthology, is that it really brings to light even using the words nature writing, because what else would you write about? Everything is nature. We are a part of nature. And Oka references that so skillfully by using those examples.
One of the things that he writes about is the fact that mountains could be consulted by humans, by the community, for wisdom, for example. We would never think of doing that here, but although we might do it unconsciously.
Absolutely. What a wonderful thing. If only we were in dialogue with the mountains, how different our regard for the natural world would be. And the idea that, I think it's tigers are a term for grandparent, the connection between nature and culture. Why would we see nature and culture as separate?
Yeah, it's completely intrinsic, but also that the fact that, as you mentioned, there are disabled gods, but people with disability would be perceived as special.
Mm-hmm. How different that is in grey, rainy UK today.
Polly Atkin is one I really enjoyed as well. And this is very much about the weather and rain in particular. Polly lives in the Lake District, quite a wet part of the world. And she comes up with this term, I'm not sure if she did or somebody else did, of human barometers. And this whole notion, particularly when you're disabled or have a chronic illness, how weather can have a huge impact on well-being and the ability to function.
Absolutely. And I think anyone that lives with illness, particularly pain, for long enough will notice fluctuations in relation to the weather. And so Polly has really explored that in great depth, and the kind of parallels with a lot of nature writing or a lot of mantra around there's no such thing as bad weather, just bad clothing. When we are ill, we say we are under the weather.
Yes.
And particularly ill people, that really is quite literal, that sense that when the air pressure changes, or if it changes too quickly, or if it gets too high or gets too low, it affects each of us quite differently and we become quite sensitive to it. So to be able to track that is really, really valuable. And she references there was a project that looked at that and identified there's real science behind it too.
Yeah, it's interesting because Sally Hubern mentions that as well with the wind. Shetland, she lives in Shetland, which is probably one of the windiest places around. But the different wind, depending on the direction it's coming from or going to, affects her in different ways as well.
It's incredible, isn't it? The sensitivities and again, that knowledge that we develop through these experiences, I think, is so interesting. And it brings a whole new layer of experience of weather and wind and being able to tell if it's an easterly or a southerly because different parts of your body is in pain or different joints are affected is a really forensic level of examination of the weather and the environment, I think.
Polly has actually written a book about Dorothy Wordsworth too, who was unwell for a good part of her life and absolutely hated rain too, probably for the same reason, because her body couldn't handle it.
For sure. Yes, Recovering Dorothy is a fantastic book. And I really enjoy how Polly relates back to Dorothy quite often in her work and how she talks about her work too. And Dorothy is one of the people who writes kind of quite early on around having bought the outside in, a bit like Abby Palmer. And Dorothy adopted a robin who would come and visit her, and she bought plants indoors, and her bed overlooked the window so she could see outside all the time and could open the windows when the weather was fine. So that real sense of the connection between people living with chronic illness and how crucial and valuable that connection is with the outside world, but in ways that might just look quite different to what we expect from in the usual regard, I guess, for going walking or hiking or climbing, that it might be a much smaller, more intimate experience, but I think no less valuable.
Another word that comes up a lot is ableism, and actually how ableism is revered, that ability to walk and to climb and to get to the top of the mountain and to share that experience. And this kind of blows it out the water, actually.
Thank you. I'm so pleased. And again, it's only when you hear or read or experience a particular perspective that, again, those layers of ableism are revealed. And my own experience too, you wait to get better. That's what we learn. That's what we expect, is that you get sick and then you recover. And so when you don't recover, there isn't a narrative. There isn't a sense of what happens then. And I think this book and my own writing has come very much from that space of, as much as there's an absence and a loss with that, there's also the opportunity to create our own stories and our own narratives, the creativity that can be born from that, that does implicitly dismantle that sense of ableism, where there is an expectation that we will get better and then resume and reconnect with the world, that actually there's an awful lot that can be gained and can be learned from people who do experience the world in those in-between places of not getting better.
One really good example of that is Eli Clare, who you mentioned already, just so illuminating. And they start off by talking about the rarely talked of thing within the disabled community of sliding, scooting, crawling, crab walking, moving close to the ground, actually getting your body around to places.
It's wonderful, isn't it? Yeah. And I think it captures so much about ableism and about the nature of being in nature, connecting with the outside world, but also of community with other disabled people. He's exploring the woods and talks about how trees don't gawk, that we don't get judged, we don't get shamed by the trees in the woods, we don't have expectations of productivity or athleticism or the kinds of things that are regarded in Western capitalist society, which otherwise misses out on all of these amazing stories and joyous, incredible, knowledgeable people about different experiences they've had.
I love the way that they say that that the natural world is a world that relishes crookedness as well.
Absolutely.
Because nothing is perfect. There are no perfect lines. Actually, the beauty is in all the difference and the character of it all.
And that really echoes my own experience in terms of seeing and really rejoicing in locally the woods, the trees that have come down in the storms over the last year or so, and then seeing new growth coming up and the resilience, for want of a better word, of how the natural world just continues. There is an ongoingness, whether it's a cycle of decay or a cycle of growth, it's part and parcel of the same process. And I think Eli Clare's piece responds really strongly to that, that sense of the richness of the natural world and the acceptance that he experiences within that.
And also highlights pretty obvious stuff, well, it should be obvious, about how other people perceive disabled people in the way that there can be hostility, or how patronising people can be, varied reactions, which makes the disconnect bigger with other people, and the perhaps the connection to the natural world stronger.
Absolutely. And I think there's all kinds of reasons for that. I think fear is a lot of that. And one of the things I've been really struck by is how common chronic illness and disability is, and yet how marginalised it is. It affects something like a third of the population and will ultimately affect all of us one day. But the kind of collective denial around that, I think, perpetuates this sense of shame and blame responsibility, that it's our fault somehow, which is an added burden that we share collectively, which life could be a lot easier. It could be much different if there wasn't that to contend with in addition. And that sense of anything, anyone who's even slightly different to what that norm of society is, and that norm of society so often being actually quite a small proportion of the population. And so any difference is regarded, I think, suspiciously and hostilely.
Louise Kenward and the anthology Moving Mountains, Writing Nature Through Illness and Disability is out now. Please get in touch and tell us where you listen to this podcast. We always love to hear from you. Email outofdoors@bbc.co.uk. I'm Helen Needham. Thanks for listening.
Gail Katz told friends she was leaving her husband, Bob, then went missing. On season one of The Girlfriends, Bob's ex-girlfriends came together to bring him down and seek justice.
I can't believe this.
Now on season two, host Carol Fisher is back, working to solve the mystery of another missing woman.
It's almost like it's become this, you know, moral obligation to find her.
Listen to The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Girlfriends, Our Lost Sister, and start listening.